phone calls last night and one this morning canceling the three congregations I normally pastor in Wisconsin. With wind chill, it was supposed to be in the mid to upper 20s or lower 20s, depending on which way you look at it, minus temps today, plus about 2 to 3 inches of snow. So we just thought it prudent not to have services. So even though it's cooler for you here, it's still warmer than back home, and I'd rather be here. So it's nice to be with you. Nice to have my family. We're taking an extended trip while our children are out of college for the winter break, and thought we would just take advantage of that. It's been very nice spending the time with the Martins. Enjoyable to get away and be able to have conversations with fellow pastors, talk about different things. It's interesting how much is in common, but every place is different, personalities and so forth. It's been nice meeting some of you here. I know the O'Briens from Cincinnati. When I was a boy, they were in Cincinnati. It's nice to see them again and many others that we know here from this area. Do I have to mirror this? I'm not sure if it's... It was picking it up earlier, but now it's on the other screen. Let me reset this and see if it's going to pick it up. There we go. It doesn't look like it, but it's there. The first screen's always black. God works with us in some very interesting ways and in dramatic fashion at times. Those that he has worked with down through times, no different. Even for us, oftentimes we can read items from Scripture and we can think how dramatic things were in times past and forget that we're living in our own dramatic times. As we approach Passover, and it seems like it's a number of months away, but it's going to be here faster than we realize. One of the favorite stories of that time period is, of course, the story of Exodus. I remember it was almost an annual event when I was a boy growing up that they would play that movie on television. It was always one that I looked forward to watching to be reminded of that time. And that whole story is very fascinating, not just the Exodus portion, but what led up to it, especially. God had decided to work with the descendants of Abraham some 500 years prior to that. Through the sons of Jacob, God took Israel to Egypt. I think most of us are familiar with those stories. But in working with Israel, part of why he chose them was to be a nation that would be an example of his way of life to the world around them. They were to be a righteous example of living God's law so that they would know, the surrounding nations would know what God expected of mankind and how to live his way of life. They were to be that type of witness. I'd like to begin in Genesis 15 today, if you'll turn there with me, just to sort of help set the stage here, because what's oftentimes forgotten in this whole story of Israel eventually ending up in what God called the Promised Land, what was later called Israel and in a modern sense today is called Palestine, there were people already living there. And God had determined in dealing with them that they were not going to stay there forever. So in Genesis 15 and verse 7, we pick up the story. God says, I am the Eternal who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans, speaking here to Abram, as he was known at the time, to give you this land to inherit it. And so then Abraham responds, Lord God, how shall I know that I will inherit it? Just a simple question. And so then God replies and says, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. And so he did. He brought all those things to him. Verse 10, he cut them in two down the middle, placed each of them on the opposite side of each other, but he did not cut the birds in two. What's missing oftentimes, people can read over very easily in this section here, is that what is happening is a covenant is being made. And covenants almost always involved animal sacrifices. And there was a component of food and shared items. We even have this in a modern sense. Most people don't think about this, but in our marriage ceremonies, we do something very similar. So in verse 11, when the vultures began to come down on the carcasses, Abraham drove them away, or Abram. And so then verse 12, the sun was going down, and a deep sleep fell on him. Behold, horror and great darkness. And he said to Abram, God did, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. God was telling Abraham in advance, before those descendants ever existed, that he was going to allow them to go to Egypt and be in servitude. Verse 14, however, he says, "And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. And afterward they, his descendants, Israel, shall come out with great possessions." This is a very interesting item here. Can you imagine having this kind of conversation with God? Verse 15, "Now for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age." This is very reassuring to Abram. And then verse 16, "In the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete." So the Amorites lived in the land. God saw their sin, and he knew that if it did not change, that he was going to remove them. That fact alone is very interesting, but what's an interesting component to it is that God is extremely merciful and patient, even with those whom he is not directly calling. Oftentimes in the Old Testament, especially, God is seen as this very vengeful, very bloody, very quick to anger God. But he says here he's essentially going to wait 400 years to correct them. But remember, back in 13 and 14, those verses, he said that he would judge Egypt. I believe that God allows us, oftentimes, to suffer along with the world around us. He does so, I believe, so that we might have God's truth reinforced. Did this get passed down? I suspect it did. Maybe they forgot it at times. But look at you and I. We know what's coming for this nation, the world around us. We know what God promises in terms of the fulfillment of his holy days, his plan of salvation. And yet, in a large degree, we're going to suffer for a time with the world before those things all play out. And I think part of that, a big part of that, is so that we're fed up with the world around us. We want nothing to do with it. If God knew that the Amorites were going to be punished, then why have Israel go to Egypt until that time? Why not move them someplace quieter? If God knew that Egypt would be punished, why did he send Israel there, knowing they would be in servitude? Why not have them go someplace else? What did either of those punishments have to do with Israel? Or even the Exodus? Today I want to take the sermon time then to consider what it meant for Israel, and by extension us today, to come out of the world and to cease from sin. And the story, as I mentioned, of Exodus is a very powerful story. It's been told in movies, it's been told in books, it's been repeated down through time. The themes of it are repeated in a number of different ways. And I believe the story of the Exodus resonates with people because it pictures the success of the underdog, the downtrodden that eventually came out from underneath oppression. And there's so many lessons for us to consider in that story. They were spiritually downtrodden, and yet God delivered them. We can see the same thing in our lives. The Israelites had become so part of the world around them that they began to accept their beliefs. I think that was part of why God allowed them to go through some of the plagues, as we'll see here in a moment. But many times we're affected or afflicted by the sins of the world around us as well. We're recipients of bad choices that the world makes. In John 17, we're not going to turn there, but verses 14 to 17, Christ in his prayer before the night before his crucifixion, he was praying to the Father, and he was asking the Father that he would keep us, all of the faithful down through time, all that God would call, that he would keep us because we were not of the world. We can oftentimes think we can lose track because of the focus that we have on God's way of life. We can lose track that the world doesn't think like us. You look at the culture, you look at the language, you look at the entertainment, you look at the politics, the way business is done, How many times have you shaken your head? I don't know why they do this. Let's go to Exodus chapter 1. We'll pick up the story there. Of course, at the end of Genesis, Israel did move down to the land of Egypt. The famine that had overtaken the land, you know those stories. The sons that had been sitting down to buy grain and how it had been worked out to be revealed that Joshua was going to deliver them, that they were going to be saved through him. And they ended up staying in a very pleasant part of Egypt, and they multiplied. So Exodus 1 and verse 9, a new king had arisen, and he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen that in the event of war, they join with our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." They became threatened by the Israelites that were living amongst them. They began to fear them instead of seeing the blessing that came from them. So verse 11, "Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew." So even in the midst of this punishment, this oppressive work that they were doing, God blessed them. And they, the Egyptians, were in dread of the children of Israel. And so the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. They just wore them down, used them up like animals. But it's interesting, again, that God increased them. And oftentimes the same will happen with us. In the time of physical adversities, God will bring us great spiritual blessings. Look at many of the faithful down through time and how God blessed them, especially spiritually, in the midst of great, deep, long trials. As we moved into chapter 2, then Moses comes on the scene. He is born, his mother especially, but his parents spared him, put him in the basket. Of course, you are probably familiar with the story, how the sister of Pharaoh drew him out. And there's great meaning even in his name. We'll come to that in a moment. Let's pick it up in verse 5. It says, "The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe in the river, and the maidens walked along the riverside. When she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. When she opened it, she saw a child, and behold, the baby wept, and so she had compassion on him and said, 'This is one of the Hebrews' children.'" Now, if you remember the end of chapter 1, Pharaoh had ordered the killing of all the baby boys. She probably knew who this was, that this was a Hebrew child. And so it's no small statement when it says she had compassion on him, because she understood this. The end of verse 6, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." And so then in verse 10, it says, "The child grew. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter." This is actually interesting because his mother became his nurse, if you will. She raised him, and how hard that would have been. Turn him over to another woman that would be called mother. But he grew. She brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, "Because I drew him out of the water." And that's what that word means. Some think that that's a Hebrew derivation of an Egyptian word. You'll notice that a lot of the Pharaoh kings had Mos or Moses at the end of their names. And so some think that it was derived from that. But nonetheless, he was pulled out of the water. God saved him to save a nation. God was going to draw out, if you will, and rescue Israel through this individual primarily. If we move over to chapter 4 and verse 27, we come down to the time then when God is directing Moses to go before Pharaoh. In the meantime, Pharaoh had grew in stature. Many historians believe that Moses was a great military leader, a general of the Egyptian armies. And so he had great ability. He was probably second after the first prince in line to the throne. And so then in chapter 4 and verse 27, it says, "The Eternal said to Aaron, 'Go into the wilderness and meet Moses.' And so he went and met him in the mountain of God and kissed him. And so Moses told Aaron all the words the Eternal of the Eternal who had sent him and all the signs which he had commanded him. God was going to have Moses, if you remember the story, go before Pharaoh. And so then Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the children of Israel, and Aaron spoke the words which the Eternal had spoken to Moses. If you remember, Moses had said to God, I can't speak. He was trying to get out of a responsibility. I'm not eloquent enough. God got mad with him, finally said, fine, I'll let Aaron do it. And so this is what they're doing. 31, the people believed. They heard that the Eternal had visited the children of Israel and that he had looked on their affliction when they bowed their heads and worshipped. So then we move into chapter 5, verse 1. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, thus says the Eternal God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. And so then Pharaoh replies, who is this Eternal that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I don't know who this is, so I won't let you go. Verse 3, and so they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert, sacrifice to the Eternal our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or the sword. And the king of Egypt said, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? You're just trying to dodge your responsibilities. Get back to work. Initially, God was simply asking them to asking Pharaoh to let them go into the wilderness to worship. I think God knew what Pharaoh's response was going to be, but this is the first request. And why was God having them do this way? Why have them go to Pharaoh at all? I'm sure God could have had Israel leave Egypt in some other fashion, some other way. But I believe he's leading up to something here. And if we go back to verse 2, Pharaoh, remember, said here, who is the Eternal? The Egyptians had a plethora of gods. And the first god that the Egyptians would interact with was Pharaoh. Pharaoh was considered a god, the representative of the gods on earth. And so, if you can imagine, place yourself in the place of Pharaoh here, who is supposed to be a god, and you have somebody come and says to you, I have this other god we need to go worship. He's going to say, they're no god. I'm in charge. I think God is building up here a scenario, if you will, of what he wants to show Egypt and what he wants to show Israel. Pharaoh was not the same as the rest of the people. He was considered not only physically different, but spiritually different. He had a connection to the gods. But God is not without a sense of irony. We'll come to that more as we go along. Remember what we read back in Genesis, that God was going to judge Egypt. And it started with Pharaoh. They worshipped virtually every aspect of the creation except the Creator. They had access to an understanding of God when Jacob and the rest of Israel came to Egypt. You remember the story of the visions and what God did through Jacob in the years of plenty, preparing for the years of famine. So if I could paraphrase here in verse 2, basically what Pharaoh is saying, as one God to another, I don't know you. So if we can go back to chapter 3, I want to highlight something in verse 14. Because Moses asked God, who do I tell them is sending me? Because they had been in servitude for 400 or so years. And as I mentioned, they had forgotten God. Because as slaves, they had no right to believe anything else. They didn't control their days. They didn't determine when they got up, when they went to work, or anything. And so God says to Moses here, he says, tell them, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you, the Eternal, the self-existent one. This was a God that not only Israel had forgotten because of their slavery, but that Egypt in their arrogance had pushed aside. What I also find very interesting is that the first three plagues, as they play out, Israel suffered with Egypt. And you think, well, how is that fair? But let's continue on in the account. Let's go to Exodus 5. Exodus 5 and verse 15. Then the officers of the children of Israel came and cried out to Moses, because Pharaoh had simply made their life harder after this. He said, okay, if you've got enough time to go out in the wilderness and do these things, then obviously you're not working hard enough, so I need to up the quota here. And so you can imagine the people are upset. They cried out to Pharaoh, saying, why are you dealing with us this way? Verse 16, there is no straw given to your servants. And they say to us, make brick, and indeed your servants are beaten. But the fault is in your own people. But he said, you are idle, idle, I tell you. Therefore, say, let us go and sacrifice to the Eternal. Again, he's essentially saying, well, if you've got so much time, not only am I going to add to your quota, you can go get the supplies. Straw is sort of a binding agent within the clay. So he said, you can go cut it, you can go haul it, you can, but still make as many, if not more, brick. So the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble after it was said, you should not reduce any bricks from your daily quota. Then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them, and they said to them, let the Eternal look on you and judge. What have you gotten us into? They were pretty happy earlier. Now they're not. Because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants and put a sword in their hand to kill us. There's an interesting thing that happens when people are in captivity a long time, and different names are applied to it. One of them is Stockholm Syndrome. You begin to sympathize with your captors. Even in World War II, especially in the Japanese prisoner of war camps for the Americans, when they opened those gates, most of those soldiers wouldn't leave the camps because they had been so conditioned that if they ever did, they were going to kill people. So even in spite of seeing fellow soldiers, they were so conditioned, and I think this is in large part what's happening here. They had been such a part of this for so long, they couldn't imagine another way, and they actually saw it as being okay. What are we okay with? We can go periods of time when we're okay with things and then suddenly the culture will jerk one way or the other and we're kind of surprised, but then we get used to it, don't we? We begin to accept it. God was going to show Israel, and he's going to show us, that the world's comfort is not a comfort we should seek. And so then we go to chapter 7. God begins to do something very curious here. He begins to dismantle Egypt's gods. We can rehearse these plagues and we can miss a connection. And that's part of what I'm going to show you today. So Exodus 7 and verse 1, the Eternal said to Moses, see, I've made you as God to Pharaoh, meaning equal to him. Pharaoh couldn't do anything to Moses that God wouldn't allow. He says, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet, your spokesman. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land. Moses would end up being, in Pharaoh's eyes, far more powerful than not only Pharaoh, but any other god in Egypt. If we went back and sort of summarize chapter 2 through 6, you would see a theme, if you will, of coming out of Egypt as God commands. And that's our calling, isn't it? Not just as we approach Passover, but all year, year in, year out. The image you see on the screen there is the Egyptian god Heka. Heka was the god of the supernatural and the miracles. And what was one of the first things, what was the first plague that God did to them? It was the water to blood. The supernatural. There are many historians, even some theologians, unfortunately, say, well, that was just a mudslide up the river that made the water look red. You think Pharaoh would have been fooled by that? Do you think it would have smelled the way it did? So God begins to poke every one of their gods and show them how impotent they are. So let's read that account, chapter 7, and in verse 14. The Eternal said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is hard. He refuses to let the people go. And so then we move to this Nile god. And so to continue, you go to Pharaoh in the morning. When he goes out to the water, you shall stand by the riverbank to meet him. And with the rod which you turned to a serpent, you shall take in your hand. And you shall say to him, the Eternal God of the Hebrews has sent me to you, saying, let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But indeed, until now, you would not hear. Verse 17, thus says the Eternal, by this way you shall know that I am the Eternal. Behold, I will strike the waters which are in the river with the rod that is in my hand. It shall be turned to blood, and the fish in the river shall die, and the river shall stink, and the Egyptians will loathe to drink the water in the river. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, say to Aaron, take your rod and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their streams, over their rivers, over their ponds. See, this was not just one event that happened to impact the Nile. This was every aspect of water that you would use in daily life, drinking and cooking and washing, that they may become blood, and there shall be blood throughout the land of Egypt, both in buckets of wood and pitchers of stone. Even if it had been drawn out, it was still going to be turned to blood. And Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Eternal commanded. So he lifted up the rod, and he struck the waters that were in the river in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, and all the waters that were all in the rivers turned to blood. And the fish that were in the river died, and the river stank, and the Egyptians could not drink the water of the river. So there was blood throughout the land. Then the magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments. They mimicked it, which is pretty impressive, isn't it? It had to be pretty impressive to convince them, the Egyptians, that their magicians could do the same. Pharaoh turned and went to his house, but his heart was not moved by any of it. So the Egyptians dug all around the river for water to drink, because they could not drink the water of the river. But they couldn't. They couldn't find anything. Maybe there's a parallel here to Leviticus 17, where God says that life is in the blood. How long can you live without fresh water? So then we move to chapter 8. The second plague is the frogs that come on the scene. Verse 1, God says to Moses, go to Pharaoh and say to him, thus says the Eternal, let my people go. It's the same request. How many times would you have to hear this to change your mind, your heart? Verse 2, but if you refuse to let them go, I will smite all your territory with frogs. And so there on the screen you see Heket. Heket was the toad goddess. Might sound odd, but this goddess was seen as a goddess of growth and fertility. Those frogs were certainly fertile. They filled the land. Verse 4, the frogs will come up on you and your people, on your servants. And so God said to Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your hand with your rod over the streams, the rivers, the ponds, and cause the frogs to come up on the land of Egypt. And so Aaron did, and the frogs came. Verse 7, the magicians of Egypt again mimic this. They did so with their enchantments and brought up frogs on the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, entreat the Lord that he may take away. Pharaoh's beginning to sort of relent here. He's had enough. Maybe the people of Egypt are crying out enough. He's got to do something here. He says, take them away and I'll let the people go. Verse 9, Moses says to Pharaoh, accept the honor of saying, when I say I shall intercede for you, for your servants. So he said, to depart the frogs from you and your houses, that they may remain in the river only, back where they were supposed to be. And so then in verse 10, tomorrow he said, let it be according to your word, that you may know there is no one like the Eternal our God. The frogs will depart from you and your houses. And so Moses and Aaron left. It says, concerning the frogs which he had brought against Pharaoh, God did according to all the word of Moses, and they died. But that created another problem, didn't it? The next verse said they stank. My mom, for all my life, most of my life, I should say, from when I was about 8 or 9 years old, She never, ever cleaned out the pockets. I had four brothers, so whenever she did laundry, she never cleaned out the pockets of our jeans. Part of the reason was we used to have these little tiny frogs all over our yards. We had about 5 acres. We found them interesting. We'd stick them in our pockets because we wanted to observe them later. Well, we'd forget about them. She got tired of pulling dead frogs out of our pockets, so she just quit. If it was in your pocket, it went through the wash. It never got out. I can't imagine how bad those frogs stank, though. God is, again, poking at each one of these gods. God shows that only He is the God of life. And so then moving to further on in chapter 8 and verse 16, we come to the third plague, the lice. God told Moses, say to Aaron, stretch out your rod, strike the dust of the land that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And there are differing opinions and commentaries in different places if this was actually lice as we know lice or if this was some other insect, because the wording is not clear enough here. I don't think that it really matters because of the volume of what God was doing here. Again, He was poking at the gods. And there on the screen, you see a picture of Gep. Gep was another one of these gods, a god of earth and vegetation, things that come out of the earth. And so, as it says here, these lice were going to come out of the dust of the land. They were just going to appear in mass and overwhelm the countryside. And so then, verse 17, Aaron stretches out his hand with the rod and strikes the dust. These lice come out. Verse 18, the magicians again mimic what Aaron had done. It says they were so numerous at the end of verse 18 that there were lice on men and beasts. They just infested the land. But notice verse 19, the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. Even they were impressed. But Pharaoh's heart grew hard and he didn't heed them. Again, this movement of one plague to another follows this steady progression of God systematically dismantling and showing how impotent their gods are. And so then we come to the next god. Chapter 8, verse 20, the plague of flies. Moses is told by God, rise early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh as he comes out of the water and then say to him, thus says the Eternal, let my people go. Or else, if you will not, behold, I will send swarms of flies on you and your servants, on your people, into your houses. The houses of the Egyptians shall fill with swarms of flies, and the ground on which they stand. For some years, we lived, my family and I, up in New England, Rhode Island specifically. And in Maine in the spring, March and April, nobody would go into the woods. Because in Maine in March and April, you have the black flies that come out. And the black flies are terrible. They have teeth this huge. They're biting flies. They even irritate the moose. Any animal tries to find a place to go and hide because they are just so obnoxious. And I suspect, I wonder if it's something like this, how irritating that can be. God is telling Pharaoh through Moses here, let him go. Are you going to deal with this? But notice verse 22, in that day I will set apart the land of Goshen. That's where Israel was. God says, okay, I'm going to start showing a separation here between your people and my people. And he says, they will not deal with this. He does this, he says, to know, so that you may know that I am the Eternal in the midst of the land, and I will make a difference between my people and your people. And tomorrow this sign shall be. Khepri is the god you see up there. Khepri was connected with what was called the sacred scarab. This was the god of insects. So the god of insects can't control the insects. I don't think anybody missed that connection. The scarab was the symbol of Ra, the sun god. And again, this distinction, this separation is made between God's people and the Egyptian. God grants his people protection. We have protection on a regular basis. Back home, in many of my sermons, I remind the members there, I'm a big proponent and believer of what I call the blessing of the thing that never happened. The accident that was never there, the car that didn't break down, the money that was available when you needed it, the washer that lasted way beyond its life, all of these things. God separates us, I believe, on a regular basis, and it can be easy for us to miss that if we're not careful. God chose them to be a special people. He chose Israel to be, it says later on in Exodus, to be his special treasure. And obedience to God brings blessings, even if we're surrounded by trials and sins of the world. Do you think Israel paid attention when suddenly they saw the Egyptians receiving a continual barrage of these plagues, and yet now they were separated? Earlier they were complaining. I bet they were very thankful when they saw these things. We're reminded in Revelation 18, verse 4, to come out of the world. God is telling his people in the end time to come out of Babylon, come out of her, my people. To not engage in the things of the world around us. And so then moving into chapter 9, we come to the next plague, the plague of the death of the livestock. Chapter 9 and verse 1, God again tells Moses, go to Pharaoh and tell him, thus says the Eternal of the Hebrews, let my people go. For if you refuse to let them go and still hold them, behold, the hand of the Eternal will be on your cattle, the field, on the horses, on the donkeys, on the camels, on the oxen, the sheep, a very severe pestilence. This plague was going to strike at every animal in the land. And the Eternal will make a difference between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing shall die at all that belongs to the children of Israel. And so then God sets a time, saying, tomorrow I will do this thing in the land. And so he did. And the plague strikes all of the animals. Hathor was the cow god, face of a cow. She was the wife of the sacred bull Baki, the goddess of fertility, a goddess of motherhood. By extension, a goddess of life. And here are all of these animals, and the animal that she even represented in the cow, the sacred cow, all of this livestock dropping in death all around them. This is also an indictment against a god called Apis. This is another name for that sacred bull god. He was also a god of fertility. God is, again, systematically undoing their gods. And so then we move to verse 8 of chapter 9, the plague of boils. And God told Moses and Aaron, take for yourselves handful of ashes from the furnace, and let Moses scatter it towards the heaven in the sight of Pharaoh. What was God doing here? Another of the gods that are listed here is Khons and Thoth. Khons was the moon god. Thoth was the god of wisdom. He was to be the god that protected the physicians. This was also against the god Imhotep. Imhotep was one of the few gods in Egypt that was first a man, became a god. But Imhotep was the physician god, and much like Thoth, the god of intelligence and wisdom. But he was also a god of healing, as a god of medicine. So here, God is having Moses spread these ashes, which doesn't seem to make sense initially. But notice verse 9, it will become fine dust in all the land, and it will cause boils to break out and sores on man and beast throughout all the lands of Egypt. No medicine could touch this. And they have this plague of boils. And I don't know if you've ever had a boil. I've had a few when I was a boy. They are amazingly painful. Can you imagine, like Job, having your whole body break out in boils? And here's a god that's supposed to protect you. Verse 11, the magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils. They no longer have any ability to mimic any of this. It says the boils were on all of the Egyptians, but God hardened the heart of Pharaoh. God is going to break this power. And so then we continue moving here to chapter 9, verse 18. Before we leave that, I want to make reference to a verse, Psalm 103, verse 3. God promised us as a God that he would heal all of our diseases. He is the God that heals, not false gods like Imhotep and others. And so this next plague comes on the scene, and this is the plague of hail. Verse 18, we'll pick up the story. He says, behold, tomorrow about this time I'll cause a very heavy rain to rain down, such as not been in Egypt since its founding until now. Therefore, ascend now and gather your livestock, those that were still alive, all that you have in the field, for the hail will come down on every man, every animal which is found in the field, and is not brought home, and they shall die. Now, I don't know, I don't think you get hail down here, do you? Sometimes? Okay. It can be a pretty ferocious thing to happen. But when you look at the severity of this, these were not small pea-sized pieces of hail. They were huge. They were big enough to kill people and animals when they fell. That's a pretty severe storm if you understand how hail is made. It's water that's dropping and freezing, but it's being blown back up, collecting more moisture and freezing, and it keeps this cycle until it's too heavy and it falls. So I can't imagine what kind of storm this was to create pieces of hail big enough to kill people when they fell down. God here is again striking at the gods of Egypt. And you have Nut and Isis, the god and goddess, the god Nut and the goddess Isis. These again were various gods of protection. Nut or Nut was the goddess of the sky. Osiris or Isis was considered one of the mother gods. And this was supposed to be one of the premier goddesses of life. And yet, she's not bringing life, she's bringing death. And so, again, God hardens the heart. They don't follow. The hail comes in verse 22. There was hail and fire mingled with the hail. I suspect this was something like severe lightning storms. I know you get those down here. It says, fire darted to the ground, and the eternal rained hail on the land of Egypt. So there was hail and fire mingled with the hail, so very heavy that there was none like it. The hail struck out through the whole land of Egypt, and all that was in the field, both man and beast. The hail struck every herb of the field, broke every tree of the field. Only in the land of Goshen, where the children of Israel was there no hail. It just pounded everything that was left exposed. And so you can imagine Pharaoh starts to relent here. So he calls for Moses and Aaron, verse 28, entreat the eternal that there be no more mighty thunderings and hail, for it is enough. I will let you go. But Moses is on to him here. He says, as soon as I've gone out of the city and spread out my hands, he says, you'll change your mind. He says, verse 30, I know that you will not fear the eternal God. But notice, this was at a time of harvest. The flax and the barley were struck. It was ready to be harvest. The wheat, the spelt. None were spared. Verse 35, so the heart of Pharaoh was hard. At this point, he's probably just so angry, he won't even consider the idea of letting them go. And so then we come to chapter 10, the eighth plague, the plague of locusts. Whatever was left alive now, you're going to have these locusts come behind and eat. Locusts are very interesting creatures. They're basically grasshoppers on steroids. Literally. There's a genetic change that takes place within them, and they become massive, and they become voracious. There was actually a huge cloud of locusts very early in this nation's history that went across the Midwest, and it pretty well just cleared the land. They ate so much. So chapter 10, verse 1, says, "The Eternal said to Moses, 'Go into Pharaoh. I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that they may show these signs of mine before them.' I want the world to see," he says, "and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and your son's sons and the mighty things I have done in Egypt, my signs which I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Eternal," that there would be no doubt left in anyone's mind. And that's exactly what happened, isn't it? To this day, people tell this story, whether they believe it or not. So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, verse 3, tells them the same thing again. "How long will you refuse to humble yourself? Let my people go that they may serve me. Or else if you refuse to let my people go, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your territory." The god Seth was the god of crops. He's also the god of storms. And so here's a god bringing not a refreshing rain after a long, hard, hot season that needed it, but he's bringing again destruction. Geb was also a connected god to this, a god of vegetation. He says, "They're going to be so numerous," verse 5, "these locusts, that they'll cover the face of the earth so that no one will be able to see the earth, and that they shall eat the residue of what is left." That is, that was left from being pounded by the hail. So then even Pharaoh's servants are turning on him. Verse 7, "How long shall this man be a snare to us? Let these men go that they may serve." Look, just let them out of here so that we can have some relief. So again, Pharaoh pretends in verse 8, "Go and serve your God." But who are the ones that are going? So now he's trying to negotiate with them. "Well, I'll let you go, but who's going?" "We'll go out," Moses says, "with our young and our old, our sons and our daughters, our flocks and our herds. We'll go. We'll hold a feast of the Eternal." And then he said to them, "The Eternal had better be with you when I let you and your little ones go. Beware, for evil is ahead of you." He's trying to bully him here still. Verse 12, "Then the Eternal said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come on the land and eat every herb of the land. All the hail has left.' So Moses stretched out his rod and they came." Verse 14, "They went up over all the land and rested on the territory of Egypt. They were very severe. Previously there had not been any locusts, nor were there any such after them, for they covered the face of the whole earth and it was darkened." I can't imagine how that was, to be so numerous that it would literally darken the sky. So then Pharaoh seems to relent again in verse 16. He says, "I have sinned." He never said that before. "I have sinned against the Eternal, your God, and against you. Please forgive my sin only this once," like he had not done this before. "Only this once entreat the Eternal, your God, that he may take away from me this death." So they did. God turned, it says, a very strong west wind and took the locusts far away, blew them into the Red Sea, and there remained not one of them in the territory. But Pharaoh's heart was still hard. He didn't let them go. And so then we move to the ninth plague, the plague of darkness. This one, I suspect, was very overwhelming. Have you ever been anywhere that was so dark you couldn't see anything? I had a friend from high school, the year after we graduated, we went down to central Kentucky. He had an aunt that lived down there, and she had all kinds of caves over her property. She had, 100, 200 acres down there. That area of Kentucky is riddled with caves, limestone caves. We went into this one cave that wasn't very deep, probably an eighth of a mile. By the time we kind of snaked around and got to the back of it, we thought, well, how dark is it? So we decided to turn off our lights. It was so dark you could feel it. Put your hand in front of your face, wave it, knowing that your hand is there, you feel it moving, you can't see a thing. This is what I picture this being. So verse 21, God again says to Moses, "Stretch out your hand that there may be darkness over the land, darkness which may even be felt." So Moses did. He stretched his hand towards heaven. There was thick darkness on the land of Egypt. 3 days. How would you know in the middle of that? They didn't have clocks. We have clocks everywhere today. How would you know how long a day was if you couldn't see a sun? I suspect some started to go a little mad because your sensories are being deprived. Your sense of where you are, even. Verse 23, they did not see one another, nor did anyone rise for his place, because where are you going to go? How do you even know where you're going? What you're going to stub your toe on in the middle of it? But all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. I don't even know what that looked like. You're in Goshen. You're looking down the Nile, and all you see is blackness. What would you think of that? Nonetheless, Pharaoh called Moses, 24, and said, "Go serve the Eternal. Only let your flocks and your herds be kept back. But your little ones can go with you." See, Pharaoh's trying to have leverage here. You're not going to leave your animals. I want something of assurance here. I want to know you're going to come back. But Moses said, "You must also give us sacrifices and burnt offerings that we can offer to the Eternal, our God. Our livestock will go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind, for we must take some of them to serve." But God again hardened Pharaoh's heart. Verse 27, he wouldn't let them go, and he's getting angrier and angrier. "Take heed to yourself and see my face no more." There's an old expression, "Be careful what you wish for." Because Moses did not see Pharaoh's face anymore, nor did Pharaoh. You have Ra and Khepri there, both connected to the sun. Ra was supposed to be the most powerful of the gods, the god of the gods. And yet he was powerless to bring them light. And so then we come to the 10th plague. The death of the firstborn. Everything up to this point affected them outside of family. It affected animals, it affected crops, it affected how they felt. But this is hitting them at the heart of where they live. And so then God tells Moses again in chapter 11 to go and bring one more plague on Egypt. And he said, "I'm going to bring death. They're going to drive you out after this one." And so they did. Israel had become comfortable in Egypt. But now you have all these gods that have been paraded before, not only the Egyptians, but the Israelites, to show everyone who was the only true God. Who was the only God that would take care of them? The only God that could bring not only calamities, but blessings. The greatest God on earth, Pharaoh, was proven to be nothing. The God of the gods was proven to be nothing. All of the gods were proven to be nothing. Along this account, Pharaoh offered compromises to God's request repeatedly. Six times from chapter 8 through chapter 10. But there are no compromises with God's way of life. Every time Pharaoh offered a compromise, God did not accept it. To compromise spiritual truth is the way of the world. Look at the season we just came out of. Pagan superstitions and teachings and beliefs that are overlaid with a mask of Christianity that teaches falsehood. A month or so earlier, 2 months earlier, we had the holiday of Halloween, one of the most evil days of the year that we celebrate in a culture, a day of death. Every time Pharaoh sought a compromise with Moses, the response was the same: "Let my people go." Our response to sin should always be the same. God has instructed us in righteous living. We should never compromise that. God did punish Egypt for her sins, as he promised Abram that he would do. But he also, as I highlighted, allowed Israel to endure three of those plagues. Let me read to you again. You can read with me. Chapter 10, verse 1. The Eternal said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine before him, that you may tell in the hearing of your son and your son's sons the mighty things I have done in Egypt, and my signs which I have done among you, that you may know that I am the Eternal." So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh and said to him, "Thus says the Eternal God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me, to let my people go that they may serve me?" In Isaiah 46, verses 9 and 10, we're told, God recounts there. He says, "I am God, and there is none like me." The world around us has forgotten God. We ceased to be a Christian nation a long time ago. And the world as a whole has embraced the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And sometimes God allows us to be a witness to the price of sin so that we can be more fully reminded that He is the Eternal. He is the one true God. There is no other like Him. And even though the world around us has forgotten God, I can only imagine what they will think once the day of the end time begins, when those tribulations begin to rain down on the world around us. I think they're going to know like Pharaoh knew, like the rest of Egypt knew. As we approach those days of Passover and unleavened bread, those are things that we need to be thinking about. How immersed are we in Egypt? And what will it take for God to show us there is nothing there of value? The plagues on Egypt were more than a mechanism for deliverance. They were there for God, or Egypt's punishment as well. And in many ways, God was showing great restraint. He could have simply wiped them out from the beginning. In fact, in chapter 9, verse 15, he says that. He says, "Now, if I had stretched out my hand and struck you and your people with pestilence, then you would have been cut off from the earth. But indeed, this is for my purpose I have raised you up, that I may show my power in you, and that my name may be declared in all the earth." He was saying, in essence, look, if I wanted to kill you, I could have killed you. But even in the midst of that, he was trying to teach Egypt as well. They had the wrong gods. But how much did Israel learn? They saw, they remembered for a time, but they were quick to forget, weren't they? Hemmed up against that sea, mountains on the side, Pharaoh behind them when he changed his mind and he came racing after them. But God nonetheless continued to work with them. God used this, I believe, as a crucible to teach his people, to make Israel a true nation. They were slaves, and he was going to make them a nation that had his laws, his statutes, his judgments. They needed to see a different way of life. They had to understand that they had access to that life, that they would be an example to all the world. The same is even more true for us. We go through trials in this world. We suffer along with the sins of the world around us. Look at the poor business practices. Look at the divide we have in this country politically. It's not going to end well. The greed, the lust, the hatred, the rejection of God's way, the worship of false gods we see in the holidays, all that sin bears fruit. And God could simply remove us, as he could have simply removed Israel. But there are lessons for all of us to learn in rejecting sin. It has to be something we desire. Let's conclude back in chapter 5, Exodus chapter 5. Verse 2, Pharaoh says, "Who is the Eternal that I should obey his voice?" God showed him. He had power over the land, the weather, the water, life itself. He says, "I don't know the Eternal, nor will I let Israel go." But this is the very God he should have been worshiping. This is the God we are to worship. A God who does not seek to punish us, but rather teach us in love, his way of life so that we can have eternal life. By the time Israel saw the conclusion of these plagues, can you imagine how ready they were to leave? There was nothing left for them, nothing they wanted. They did go out with a high hand, and if you read the account, they spent at least one day going to every Egyptian and collecting payment for 400 years of servitude. They didn't pillage them, they took payment. And if you go to Exodus further on, you read what they took out. The cloth, the gold, the silver, the brass. I don't know how they carried it all. But the wealth overnight that they had, that God gave them from the Egyptians, they were done with Egypt, at least for a time. And they saw what God wanted them to see. But the question remains for us, are we done with sin? Are we done with the world around us? Or are there gods with a little g that have not yet been vanquished in our life? The calling of a Christian is all about coming out of sin. We're not there yet. Just like Israel wasn't like that before the first plagues took place. But perhaps God is allowing us, like Egypt, become so tired of this world for us to get to a point where we see that there's nothing there that is of value for us, that we yearn and are eager to leave it. Now is the time for us to come out of the world. Let us all look forward to the time of our true spiritual exodus.